Welcome to the Good Reading Podcast, proudly sponsored by Book People Gift Cards. A Book People gift card is the perfect gift for readers of all ages. Simply order your gift card online at bookpeoplegiftcards.org.au. Redeem at any one of over 500 bookshops across Australia. Visit bookpeoplegiftcards.org.au.
If I'd wanted an image to sum up everything that's disturbed me in my first 3 weeks of acute psychiatry at Menzies Hospital, and in a strange way, what I've loved about it, I have it now. A slight woman in a Tweety Bird nightie and untied blue satin dressing gown is walking down the white hallway of the Mental Health Services acute unit, flanked by two uniformed police officers, powerless, vulnerable, and probably with no idea why she's here. Acute psychiatry is the emergency medicine of mental health, for the stuff nobody saw coming, until someone close to them becomes paranoid or overdoses or begins cutting themselves or waving a knife around a Shantini, the woman being brought into the ward did a few hours ago. Today may be the lowest point of her life. In the next hours and days, we'll have a chance to do something about it, to work out what disease or situation is behind the crisis, to treat it and to find a path forward. The cops, a tall male and a wide female, swaggering to accommodate the equipment on their belts, look relaxed, smiling, chatting, but they're not touching her. Seems wise. I'm reading in her body language that irritability that sometimes accompanies psychosis. Don't poke the bear, guys.
Anne Buis is the Chair of Women's Mental Health at the University of Melbourne and has over 30 years clinical and research experience in perinatal psychiatry. Anne is also the author of several psychological thrillers, including Medea's Curse, Dangerous to Know, This I Would Kill For, Locked Ward, and The Long Shadow. Graham Simsion was an IT consultant before he became the international best-selling author of The Rosie Project, The Rosie Effect, The Rosie Result, and The Best of Adam Sharp. As a husband and wife team, Anne and Graham have co-authored two books of fiction, Two Steps Forward and Two Steps Onward. Today I'm talking to Anne and Graham about their third collaborative novel, The Glass House. Anne and Graham, welcome to the Good Reading Podcast.
Nice to talk to you, Greg.
Great to be here.
The acute psychiatric ward in the fictional Menzies Hospital is the setting for your novel. The opening scene immediately awakened me to the reality. It was like being there in the ward. Then I wondered if reading about it as non-fiction would have given me the same feeling. What does fiction as a vehicle for telling stories about mental health allow you?
Well, the most basic thing is when telling mental health stories, there are plenty of stories that people wouldn't want told because of questions of privacy and so forth. So, I mean, Anne, you can expand on that.
I couldn't write this as nonfiction. There'd be way too many ethical issues. At one stage I was thinking about writing my original book, Medea's Curse, about infanticide as nonfiction, but I kind of thought of my patients, even if they gave me permission, walking past it and just having the scab taken off their wound every time they saw it. So fiction just opens a lot of doors. And the reason I thought Graham might have said was what inspired me to put it in fiction was I think it's such an important area for people to understand. And I think over the last 5 years through COVID, it's become a real issue that people kind of are ready to start thinking about. And this seemed to be what we were trying to head for, to really get people to think and maybe change some attitudes. And what inspired that thought was the Rosie Project. Graham?
5 million people bought the book. So it got to a lot of people who wouldn't have read an article about autism, for example. And I think it's been instrumental. It's been important, at least, in changing attitudes towards autism, to improving acceptance. So you're reaching a wider audience. You're reaching them by way of entertainment. You're giving them something that they're going to enjoy reading rather than something that they feel they ought to read. And then perhaps a bigger audience and a different audience.
I also found it to be quite an immersive reading experience. Is that something you're aiming for too?
Well, we want you to be gripped. we want you to want to keep reading. And I mean, it's always a challenge when you're writing when you're writing fiction particularly, because people, I think, have high expectations of story in fiction. If you say, well, this really happened, they'll say, yeah, well, it's boring, I guess, but that's the way it happened. Whereas in fiction, they know you have control over story and they have pretty high expectations about tension, about jeopardy, about wanting to read on. So, you know, we've done our best with that.
We're introduced to 27-year-old Hannah Wright, 3 months into her stint as registrar. She clearly has the training. What's the reality of a career in psychiatry for Hannah Wright at Menzies Hospital?
Well, it's a complicated system, the medical system, and you have to do all those years at university. Then you do an intern or residency year, and then you start. A lot of people will work in hospitals for a year or two to get experience and work out what they want to do. But then they'll almost invariably apply for a program. Now, that might be general medicine, it might be surgery, it might be general practice. Psychiatry is one of those options. And when I trained, you know, many years ago, there were relatively few positions. It probably wasn't as popular. Now there's a lot more positions, but it's a lot more popular with a lot of women wanting to access it. But you do have to do an interview. You do have to, you know, get past a few hurdles. And in this case, we've kind of created a particularly big one for Hannah, who has kind of rubbed up badly against Professor Gordon, who sees something in her that Hannah really doesn't want to face.
When you ask about the reality for Hannah, she's a doctor. She's done all the study of medicine, but she hasn't done very much psychiatry. So this is really the beginning of an entirely new world for her, and she's 3 weeks in. So we join her as a very inexperienced trainee psychiatrist, but a moderately experienced young doctor.
Yeah, look, I think if you look at medical students and then young doctors, they have an experience of success. And we do this in one of the chapters where one of them gets pulled apart, which still happens quite a lot in the particularly patriarchal hierarchy of medicine, though it's not always men that are doing the pulling apart. There are female physicians and surgeons that do it too. But we're not used to failing. We're not used to not getting through things because medicine is hard to get into, but once you're in, it's a bit of a sausage machine. It's sort of like you're expected, you've had so much money invested in you already, you're expected to get through and you will really be helped and pushed. And most people, if they really want to make it, will. And so to not succeed in something, and we see this quite a lot in the psych trainees at the while they're sitting the exams, and we have quite a high fail rate of some of those exams, which if we get to write many more sequels, you may get to see Hannah face some of those hurdles as well. And it's tough. They struggle with that experience.
And it's a very competitive space as well.
Oh, yes. Doctors are very competitive. And I think psychiatry is no different. And you follow with Hannah three other registrars, well, sort of three and a half. We find another one along the way. And there's no doubt that sort of competitive and that they're all dealing with their own issues and quite significant issues. You know, yes, they're privileged in many ways, but they've all come from different and in some ways difficult backgrounds and they've already overcome and they want to prove themselves.
And in terms of mental health issues, this ward has just about everything. Pregnancy psychosis, suicide attempts, manic depressives, religious delusions, schizophrenics, histrionic personality disorders, anorexia nervosa, and PTSD. That's quite a list. These are people at the extremes of their existence. Take me through some of the stories behind these people. Maybe let's start with Shan. She's left her baby in a cupboard under the sink.
And I'm going to correct you. It's people with postpartum psychosis or a woman with not schizophrenics. It's very important that the people, schizophrenia doesn't define them. They have schizophrenia, you know, they have schizophrenia, but it's not, and that's part of what we want the book to show is it's episodic. You have periods of being well. Now, some people do very well and are mostly well, and it's trying to capture that feeling that it's not just part of them. And we see Shan with postpartum psychosis get better. But this is my bread and butter in psychiatry, the real work that I do. We have more mother-baby beds in Victoria than anywhere else in the world. In Victoria, we're very well supported, but that doesn't mean it doesn't happen. Of course it does. 1 in 600 births. So it is dangerous, certainly if it doesn't get caught in time, both dangerous to the woman herself and potentially the baby. Virtually all of the ones I've seen where the baby has been put in danger or something, you know, unfortunate has happened, it's because there was an altruistic motive, just as there is in this case. When your mind starts playing tricks, when you are not in touch with reality, then your behaviour alters to represent that. And what I think we also show is how her husband struggles to deal with having lost the wife you could trust, the sane, well, she's a union organizer who's a bit of a go-getter, and she doesn't take rubbish from anyone. And suddenly, you know, she's doing some really weird things. And he's also got guilt because he wasn't there. So there's kind of those complex things that we've tried to put in with all of the cases, because almost invariably the cases I see like this, they're never straightforward. There's always complexities, the ripples that go through. And what I would say, and I think comes, I hope comes through in the book, is I really like my patients. And even when I get called in at horrible hours of the night and day, I kind of grumble on the way. But the moment I'm there, first line, I'm hooked and I'm in and I want to help this person.
One thing is that there's a lot of problems and so on. One thing they will all have in common is that they arose quickly. They came on suddenly, which is why this is set in an acute ward. So it's for the sudden onset. It's not people who've had a problem for many, many years. Well, they may have, but it's flared up. So it's straight in there. They need all of these people, no matter what their situation is, they need urgent attention. And that's what they have in common. And I think the postpartum psychosis thing that Anne is talking about, one of the characteristics there is that women who have postpartum psychosis generally get better. So they recover and go on with their lives as normal. Maybe they have another baby, they have a recurrence. But it was a very positive thing, I think, to put in is a central story in the book of someone who gets better.
What about Max, a barrister? Basil Fawlty on steroids, as you describe him.
And look, of course, and we do put in the chapter, you know, having bipolar is tough. You know, yes, if you can run yourself slightly high, it's a great place to be. And of course, a lot of people with bipolar try to do that, and it's not very successful because you then lose it and it goes out of control. So there is the definite, and we thought, we needed some light in this book. And so we have him in the ward in a frankly manic state. And I do know quite a few barristers who have got bipolar. So it's, I don't treat them. These are kind of colleagues, not my patients. So it's very real. And it's very treatable, but it also can cause a lot of pain and difficulties. And my heroine in the Natalie King books has bipolar disorder, and over four books I sort of take her through the full arc of playing with her medications versus, oh, my God, I've got a baby now. I can't play around with my meds. I've got to take them. And so we just get a little snapshot of Max and his partner and some of the issues.
Tell me about Chloe. Chloe has an eating disorder.
Chloe was particularly challenging to write, I think, for both of us. And did the draft, and I read it, and I said, you know, most of the characters come out as pretty sympathetic. We care for them and so on. But Chloe, it's a bit tough. And Anne sort of fessed up, and she said, you know what? A lot of medical people don't like people with anorexia nervosa. When I say don't like, they're doing their best, but they find them really difficult to deal with. And we just really tried to tease that out. And part of it, it seems to be, is that most of the time the people want to get well according to our definition of getting well. Whereas really with the person with anorexia nervosa, the hospital is trying to feed them and they don't want to be fed, you know, so they're at odds. And trying to help somebody with whom you're at odds, where your definition of helping them is different from theirs, is really challenging. And we really had to go back and work on writing Chloe more sympathetically. I've had some experience in my life with someone very close to me who had anorexia nervosa. So that was sort of helpful for me in imbuing this person with a greater sense of humanity.
It's important to mention that Chloe is a very small percentage, or represents a very small percentage of people with anorexia, the very, very severe chronic end. And I haven't looked after eating disorders for many years, but I used to. And this is a composed story of sort of two or three merged together that I used to look after, but with the reminder of, you know, some I've seen on call in the general hospital when they come in for medical problems and want to discharge themselves, and the medical staff go, whoa, they don't look well enough to me. And then it's making that sort of judgment of are they able to make a decision in their best interest, and am I the right person to override that or not? And these are difficult decisions. And of course, you're on a weekend, and it's, you know, 10 o'clock at night, and all of those kind of usual things thrown into the mix. And what we did with Chloe was really explore the whole family and the effects of family on the illness and the illness on the family.
James has a religious delusion going on. He believes he is Jesus Christ returned. There was a scene there where I wondered whether I should laugh or not.
And look, part of surviving, look, in medicine generally is having a bit of dark humour. So, you know, we never want to laugh at the patients, but we all find ourselves in circumstances sometimes where it is kind of hard not to. And it helps us survive and helps get through the day and make sense of, you know, and if patients can also reflect back and kind of take things lighter or see things in a different way, that's potentially going to help them as well.
We talk about laughter, and there's this thing you say, we don't want to laugh at the person or whatever. Look, I wrote a book called The Rosie Project, and people say, oh, it's lucky that we never laugh at Don. I say, rubbish. You laugh at Don Tillman all the time when you're reading that book. You laugh at his expense a lot. And I say the question really is a bigger question, because you laugh at your friends. Of course you laugh at your friends. You laugh at your family. Do you love them? Well, matter of fact, you do. And I think that what's important here is what your overall feeling about that person and their situation is at the end of it. And you've been through laughing at them, crying for them perhaps, having a lot of mixed emotions about them. But at the end, you say, look, poor old Max, I had a bit of a laugh when he did this, but then I realized how serious this was for him. Or look what James did, and he took down that nun or whatever. Well, yeah, that's a little bit of a laugh on James's behalf, but a little bit of a laugh at James. But yeah, there's light relief there, and we laugh at and with everybody, but I hope we do it in a good-natured way.
Running a psychiatric ward is quite difficult. It takes all kinds of personalities and all with different motivations. We've got doctors, nurses, consultant psychiatrists, directors, trainees, interns, nurses, psychologists, social workers, occupational therapists, and a bunch of students hanging around as well. The interpersonal and the professional tension is just as fascinating to me as any psychological thriller might have been.
When we started it, as far as Anne was concerned, being a doctor, she said, and then we've got these turkeys in management, you know, then we've got the bad guys.
For my manager, I never used the word turkey.
No. Okay. But we've got the bad guys in management, and the good guys are the doctors, the clinicians, the nurses, and so on. But management are the bad guys. And because I've come out of a business background, I said, well, hold it. Yeah, I've had a heck of a lot of time working with professionals where we felt that the professionals were up on their high horses, getting in the way of running a place efficiently, all those sorts of things, no management skills, etc. So really, when we wrote this, I owned the management character, Nicole. I said, look, she's my person. I'm going to try to inhabit her and let her be a human being rather than just the enemy. And equally, I think Anne inhabited Hannah and Nash and some of the clinicians.
And some of the frustrations. Look, the managers have a really, really difficult job. I do get that. But as a clinician where you're battling for time with your patients and you're just given another load of paperwork that you've got to fill out on every patient or another thing you've got to, we have a little bit of a go at with the hand washing module. Now, there are these five modules I have to do every year. And honestly, I have a Bachelor of Surgery. So I really need to learn about hand washing every year. I find it very frustrating.
And of course, many of these people, these professionals, are tasked with making sense of behaviours and finding a treatment for them. You've got to wonder what drives these people when many of them actually have mental health struggles themselves.
Yes, when my mother read Medea's Curse, she said, oh, we don't want psychiatrists to have mental health problems. And, you know, there's a popular myth that people go into the health professions or mental health professions in particular to solve their own problems. Look, there's a little bit of truth in that, but I think it's much more about understanding ourselves. It doesn't mean we have major mental health issues. It's about having that capacity to understand. And people from backgrounds where there was a lot of trauma or where their parents suffered because of whatever illness, need to make sense of that. And if, you know, that for whatever the reason they're channeled into medicine, psychiatry, then it really is some way of working it out. Now, what we do in the book is this sort of battle between the different kind of ends of psychiatry, the talking therapies versus where a lot of effort and money is going into the neurobiochemical. And
drugs.
Not just drugs.
Or medication.
But it's understanding what's happening by PET scans and all sorts of sort of understanding of how the brain works. And it's incredibly exciting work. And of course, the latest drug, one is the psilocybin, that it's sort of showing lots of interesting kind of positive effects that might be helpful. But like all wonder drugs, it won't be as good as we think it is, but it might help a group that haven't been able to be helped before. So there's no doubt there's some great things happening, but I think it's still going to be a long, long time before we should give up on the talking therapies. And just things like grief, you know, people come in having had a baby, but the fact that their mum died recently or even 5 years ago is often reawoken in that time period where you're looking at your own baby and your mother is not there. So that type of thing is not just neurochemicals. You need to understand the context and help that woman work through family, understand what's going on. And even if it's just helping them through the incredibly scary admission for the first time to an acute psychiatry ward, then, you know, for the family, for a young 17, 18-year-old, it can be a really scary place. And that sort of talking therapy to just support them through it is part of what we need to be doing.
Your book reminds me of the fragility of life, really, and your title, The Glass House, really captures that sense of fragility. But there's also something voyeuristic implied in that title too. But I wondered, who's looking at who?
For a long time, we referred to it as the fish tank, and that was regarded very negatively by us, our readers of lived experience, because their feeling was we were looking at them. I have to say, when I think of the staff station, to me, the glass is we're the fish tank and we're being looked in at. So it is a two-way thing, absolutely. And in some ways that's a metaphor for the book, because memoirs are fabulous at giving the experience from a lived experience person. But, you know, usually the mental health professionals are seen as one-dimensional or evil or out to get you. And that's not my experience. They're doing a really hard job. It's not to say they're perfect, but they're fighting the system. They're fighting lack of resources, and they're fighting this. I've got the KPI of, you know, I've got to have my patient out within 11 days or 16 days or whatever it is that would get the average down. And, you know, antipsychotics don't work in 16 days. And so, you know, back when I started training, we had plenty of time to allow that person to get better before we discharge them. And there were lots of problems with that system, don't get me wrong, but the pendulum's gone a little bit far in the opposite direction.
One of the challenges in writing a book like this is separating the clinical from the fictional. You both have professional specialties. For you, Anne, there must be a challenge in making the clinical readable and entertaining. And for you, Graham, perhaps something like the other way around. How do they come together? Or is it, as a husband and wife team, you actually know what the other is thinking?
Well, we do a lot of planning. So we always plan our books, and we've always helped each other in planning our books. So whether it's just one name or two names on the title, we've always done that. And I think that helps a lot. And this, we've written, like the previous books, we did alternating chapters, which was a much easier way of working. We knew what we had to do in each chapter, and did our own thing. And then went back and edited each other's. Whereas this, because this is my world and I knew physically what it looked like and how things happened, like the police coming down the corridor or the technicality stuff, it made much more sense for me to do the first run through. Graham did all of the little beginnings of each chapter, set the context of the chapter and the patient that we see in that chapter. And he did all of those, and I kind of did the first, very much a vomit draft. And then it was about going back, making sure the story arcs for each chapter as well as the story arc worked over the whole book, because we follow the sort of the background of Hannah in particular, but these other three registrars, Nash, and what's happening with the manager, Nicole. So there's all of that going on in the background too, and it had to kind of work.
So we've been talking a lot about mental health and the therapies and treatments that might apply to the people in this book. Makes me wonder, is writing your therapy your escape from such a chaotic world? Graham, who do you write for? And Anne, Does it inform your professional practice in some way?
Me, I write as a creative exercise in the same way that somebody might make a ship to put in a bottle or something like that. I'm making something and I'm making it as good as I can. And the huge kick for me doing it is that I, not that I learned something about myself, but I might make something better than I thought I could.
Yeah, look, I've always written, not well, but lots of bad attempts at novels and stories throughout my life, and then sort of started to get some technique and improve. I don't think it, I've been working clinically for a long time. I mean, I'm 35 years, I think. So I think the clinical practice and the humanness of the people I see definitely affects how I write. I think, and what I want to write about. And I think Graham's had a lot of influence on that too, with his work through the autism community and talking to them, because he's, you know, he's heard a different way of thinking. I mean, in general, psychiatry has been pretty bad on autism. Like when I went through, it wasn't in our textbook. So we missed a whole lot of people. It was only in children, and I wasn't a child psychiatrist, so therefore it kind of didn't exist until, well, actually, it obviously does. And what does that mean? Is it really a disorder? Is it much more a neurodivergency? And it's been fabulous to have the autism communities hearing them, because I think it's very similar to what you might find from mental health communities too, that they don't want, well, they have a different attitude. I think they don't want to be labelled by their illness in mental health, but to be looked at as whole people and language and acceptance and all sorts of things that really we always should have in our mind, but it's a really good reminder.
Well, this book certainly opens up that world. So, Anne and Graham, thanks so much for joining me on the Good Reading Podcast.
And thank you for having us.
Thanks, Greg.
I've been talking to Anne Buist and Graham Simpson about their collaborative novel, The Glass House. It's published by Hachette, and you can find it at goodreadingmagazine.com.au. My name's Greg Dobbs, and thanks for listening. This Good Reading Podcast was brought to you by Book People Gift Cards. Share the joy of reading with a Book People gift card. To find out more, visit bookpeoplegiftcards.org.au.